Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be looking at the year-end bestsellers and the sales for the 12 months of the year. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the top comics sold in 2019. That is all of 2019. So there's a ton of numbers to go juggle in this episode. So to help me, we've got Sam. How you doing tonight, Sam?
I'm well. How are you, gentlemen?
I'm doing good. We've also got Eric. How you doing tonight, Eric?
Doing just great, John.
Cool. So not only do we have lots of numbers, just to add to the fun, I've actually given these guys a couple of different spreadsheets. One that does a breakdown of the title statuses by month, by status, just so we can see kind of where the titles, you know, are they mainly new titles, defunct titles, you know, whatever. But I've also got the same sort of year-end spreadsheet I'd been put together in past years, and a new, improved, and quite possibly even working new prototype of a new system that's actually a lot easier to work with and has some new bells and whistles. But I'm going to be bouncing between the two, both spot-checking the new one, seeing if it's right, and also taking advantage of some of the extra features there. Now, we're recording this before we record the December numbers. There's a couple of reasons for that. One was scheduling, but two, Diamond released the year-end numbers before the December numbers. Now, part of what I do is compare the year-end numbers, particularly when they're indexed as they were this year, to what are the known reported sales on the monthly side, so we can find out what are the unreported units. Can't do that till I got the December stuff, so I actually waited till they got the December stuff out to crunch those numbers and then compute the whole thing. But it always just puzzles me as to why they released what I consider to be the data out of order like that. But, you know, hey, they're going to do what they're going to do.
No one has ever claimed Diamond was logical.
Yeah, I think they're just trying to cash in on the end-of-year excitement type stuff at the beginning of January as to, you know, how did last year do? If we look at before we get into that, the other thing that makes the year-end number crunching such fun for me, every year they change how they release the data. Last year we had, I think, 2,000 items in the top list. This year we had 500. So not as deep of a list this time. Like I said, it was indexed, so I was able to convert it to actual estimated units, all that stuff. If we look at the top comics by month, we have the top-ranked item, which was a clear winner by a decided lead, with Detective Comics 1000 having an estimated 574,705 units. Now, it did that over the course of three different months, starting back in March with most of it, and then a little more in April, and then a little bit more in May. So what we're getting with the year-end, of course, is the aggregate sales, not what was the top single month sales of a comic. I do have that on another tab, but, you know, it's not necessarily totally exciting to look at either. But that was the only thing to do over the half million mark, and one of only a handful of things to do over the quarter million. The next item on the list for the year-end bestsellers was Spawn 300, already noticing a trend of those kind of, you know, milestone issue numbers being a big deal. And with Spawn 300, it did 275,749 units. So did exceptionally well, and of course, lengthy run on that title, so not too surprised it placed up there. I'm pretty sure both of those had a plethora of variants and stuff around, I think, about a dozen each, give or take. Probably more than that, because I'm only looking at what was originally solicited. The other trend we notice at the top of the list is a lot of number ones, including X-Men number 1 with 269,153 units, Black Cat number 1 with 261,751 units, and Deceased number 1 with 250,760 units. Those five are the only things that got over the quarter million mark. And again, most of those had just a ton of variants. I think there were only maybe three variants on Deceased number one, but I could be wrong on that. It is hard to keep track of all the variants they put on these things. We did have another 50 items that sold over the 100,000 mark, one or two by just a couple hundred units. But overall, it wasn't too bad in terms of, you know, the things that sold well, doing, you know, reasonably well. There were only another three beyond the ones we talked about over the 200,000 mark. That was Absolute Carnage number one, Marvel Comics 1000, and House of X number one, with Powers of X being only a few hundred units below the 200,000 mark. So most of what we're seeing up at the top is new issues or kind of, you know, mile marker issue numbers of either the 1000 for Detective Comics, the kind of artificial 1000 for Marvel Comics, 300 for Spawn, but also 301 did fairly well for Spawn.
What I actually find most interesting is the lack of normal prices on this list.
Really, the first normal price, which I'm going to say is $399,
because it's
long
in a way.
Deceased number one, and then Batman Superman number one are the top two.
Yeah, well, and here's the thing. So you've got one in the top 10 with Deceased at rank 5 and 250,000 plus units. Then you've got two, Batman Superman number one and Deceased number two in the top 20. And then there's only a total of 8 in the top 50, meaning 499 and up represents 42 of the top 50 books. Going back to, for all the complaining we do about price point, people buy what they want and they don't care about the price.
I don't know if it's they don't care about the price, but they're more willing to do it for a House of X, Powers of X, than just a run-of-the-mill X-Men title or something.
Yeah, but I mean, and Eric, I'm sure you can help here. The one that I am most stunned by, what's going on with Black Cat number one? That seems ridiculous for what I would expect out of a Black Cat number one.
Yeah, I think we might have hit on it a little bit in the monthly that we did, but that had a high ratio J. Scott Campbell Virgin cover. And that was really what drove everything up. I think they might have also put an extended discount on it or a deep discount on it if you ordered over a certain threshold compared to a certain title beforehand. So that's one of those cases where Marvel helped kind of provide a little extra influence to retailers to bring in extra copies. I know at least the first three, and I just look at so many books that I forget it, but I know at least the first three all had J. Scott Campbell covers. But I think only the first one had the really high ratio Virgin cover. So that would be why there's the huge number there.
Was that a J. Scott Campbell or was that an Art Germ Virgin?
It could have been, you know what, it could have been an Art Germ, but I know there was a J. Scott cover. I can, of course, just look it up. That would be probably the easiest, right?
Based on my notes, they had Art Germ Virgin variant. They had a Foreman cover, another Art Germ variant, a Blank cover, a Noto variant, a Torque variant, a Dodson variant, a Game variant, a Young variant. I mean, they had so many variants on this. Everything from a 1 in 10, a 1 in 25, a 1 in 50, a 1 in 100, and the 1 in 200 for the Art Germ variant. So there was no shortage of covers on that.
Right. Yeah.
The other thing, since we're talking about it, it's interesting, and this is probably all other things, but at least looking at the information I have, the first item without a multiple variant code is all the way down at rank 137 in Batman 82.
Well, that should have had two covers.
Okay, it didn't show up that way on this.
And that's what I was wondering, and I was going to ask you, John, because there's a $4.99 cardstock and a $3.99 acetate.
That's what I was going to say. Basically, this is for the line item, and this is the part that's still causing me some headaches that I've got to work through. They're not reporting each issue as a line item. They're reporting each issue at a price point as a line item. So there's only one item code for $3.99 for that Batman 82.
Okay, but while there are two price points for the book, there's a $4.99 and a $3.99. There is not a 1 in 50. There's not some other crazy incentive on top of that.
No.
But that M in that category or whatever does not, or the item code thing, does not indicate that there are variant covers, but that there are multiple item codes. And multiple item codes for that issue at that price point.
Okay, but what could a multiple item code be that is not some sort of incentive?
It could just be an alternate cover that's freely
open order. Yeah.
Okay, fair enough.
So, John, just to clarify, on this list, the number that we see of units sold, that does take into account the different price points and they just assigned one item code to it, or it only takes into account one of the price points? So in the case of what Sam was saying with Batman 82, is it only reflective of 399, the A cover?
Yes.
Okay, so the numbers are, as I would say, fudged, because they don't actually show the total sales for Batman 82, just the price point of Batman 82.
They're not fudged, but they're not meaning what you think they mean.
Right, sorry.
And this is...
Yeah, I was going to say, if anything, they're fudged in a lower direction.
Right,
yeah, exactly. If we filter the list to just Batman and look at... I'm trying to think what's going to be a good one that we've got both of these on the list. This is what's giving me a big headache. It wasn't a big deal when you just once in a while had something at two different price points, but this is now happening on a number of books on a regular basis. And it comes down to, it used to be, well, I could just take the sales of this issue, look for the previous shipped issue, and compare it to that. I can't do that now because I've got to be careful. Do I aggregate all the known sales or all the sales at that price point? And either way, it looks misleading. This is part of what led me to do a significant rewrite on the number database number crunching process on this. Because I get why they're splitting the line items on this report by price point, but I haven't figured out a good way to kind of handle that and stuff. You know, arguably, I could do a condensed version of this that takes all the information they give at the different price points and then just collapses it down to individual issues and then kind of recompute a unit rank, a retail dollar rank, and that sort of thing.
It doesn't look like any of the alternate $4.99 versions made this list.
Or if they did, like at issue 85, we're not seeing the other version. I didn't see any where I found both versions.
Yeah, exactly, okay.
But this is the same way it's done on the monthly list, and it's causing me some headaches there, too.
Well, yeah, so the bad news with 85 is the A cover is $4.99, and the cardstock variant was $5.99.
I don't think the higher price ones here anywhere.
No, and there's usually a significant percentage difference between them. If we were to jump over to the top comics by month and filter to Batman, we could see on the monthly side... Actually, no, that's the wrong tab. It's monthly top comics data. That is the one that I think would have... Yeah. The different Batman stuff, and we could see there how the stuff all plays out. But it's one of those that, more so in 2019 than in past years, this became a bigger issue because of DC and a few other publishers routinely coming out with different price points for the same comic and stuff, and it changes how you read the data. I mean, before it was always that way, but since it didn't happen that often, it wasn't that big of a deal. But that's, again, why that item down at rank 137 on the yearly list shows just a Batman 82 with a single item code, because there's only the single item code for that acetate cover at $3.99. Had this list gone beyond 500, no doubt we would have seen the $4.99 cardstock cover of that issue as well. If we filter the top comics by month to Batman and to issue 82, we see that it sold 18,222 units, which is, of course, far below where this list kind of drops off for the yearly list at around 39,769 units or so. So this is one where it's easy to misread the data that has been presented if you don't really kind of understand what it does and doesn't mean. And it's easy not to.
Here's a question. Does that mean Savage Avengers number 6 actually didn't have a variant cover?
Where on the list is that?
Rank 239. It would be the first one on the list without.
As far as I know,
it did not have a variant cover.
Did not have a variant.
That is the first one on the list without a variant.
Oh, without multiple item codes, and therefore, yeah, without variants. Because it's possible some of the things above that are alternate covers, and in my terminology, an alternate cover is an open-to-order thing that's not an incentive cover like a 1 in 20 or something like that.
Yeah.
I am playing around with a process that would parse the notation aspect of the item to look for the 1 in X, the meter exceed, and the other kind of key phrasing and stuff to start identifying and tagging what types of covers there are. Because to me, there's a world of difference of you offer two item codes, both are available to order, versus you offer two item codes and it's a regular and a 1 in 10 versus another that's got two that's a regular and a 1 in 100 or something. You know, those things all play out a little bit differently. But just getting to where I can identify which comics have used which you know, cover gimmicks take some work. And there's no standard phrasing of how that's done to make it really easy or, you know, 100% accurate. So whatever I come up with is going to have some fudge in it, but that's just the way it is. And no doubt, once I have figured that out, somebody will come up with some other crazy cover gimmick and stuff. Hologram covers will come back or who knows what. Again, this whole bit with the acetate and the cardstock cover and whatnot is a bit much bigger deal than it used to be in terms of how frequent it is. But yeah, I do think that the reliance on those kinds of cover gimmicks is pretty heavy. The other thing that's pretty noticeable, and it was more so when I took the prototype version and did a little color coding, there's a lot more Marvel on the top of this list than DC.
Mm-hmm.
And if you filter to DC, you get kind of the usual suspects of either a Batman family title like Detective or Batman, or, you know, an event sort of a title such as Deceased or Doomsday Clock. You've got to go a little ways down before you really kind of get out of those sorts of things into anything that would be, I don't say unexpected, but like Young Justice at rank 116 is really the first thing that isn't, you know, a Batman title or a an event-ish sort of a title. And I'm lumping Batman Who Laughs in with that category as kind of a little of both. And then once you get past that, it's not until you get down to Flash at 148 where you get the next thing. And I forget what issue that was. Oh, that was the last Cold Case, which was another Batman Flash team up.
The Price Part 2. That was, they renamed the crossover to be The Price.
Ah, got it. Okay. Yeah, I'm going with how they originally solicit because that's the data I can pillage. But yeah, to me, that's part of the overarching, I won't say meta arc over at DC, but I think that's giving them a little more credit than maybe they deserve. So I do think that by and large, Marvel just did way better than DC on this. They had, out of the top 300, 167 items versus 122 for DC. So they wound up with a little over 14 million units in that top 300 versus a little over 9.8 million for DC. And then Image being a little under a million, and then, you know, Dynamite, IDW, and Boom getting on the list, but with, you know, 50 to 60,000 units apiece. Each with a single item in that top 300. So I don't think any of that is particularly surprising, because if you look back at the year, every month Marvel had the lion's share of the sales in the top 300. DC didn't outdo them a single time in 2019. Again, not too surprised by that, but I don't think that's a great position for them to be in.
No, I would agree. As a retailer, we felt it all year. We continue to feel it heading into 2020. There are some significant challenges, and it's not just in the single issues, but in their collected editions department as well. And it's multifaceted, which is probably the scarier thing. When Marvel was kind of at its lull a couple years ago, we really felt that the biggest portion of it was in the story content. And a lot of it centered around how they were adjusting their lead characters, you know, making Falcon be Captain America. We had a female Thor, which did turn out to be a great story. But then you add in just all the additional character swaps they did, felt forced, stories didn't resonate with readers. We're feeling some of the same issues with DC in the sense that stories aren't resonating, that the characters don't ring true. But even more than that, we've got just plain old publishing problems with collected editions being canceled. We have a significant amount of retailer feedback to DC about their variant cover practices and how they've chose to go away from the ratio variant, but instead have started putting their top tier artists on store exclusive variants and not on actual standard able to be ordered covers. And that has been at the detriment of sales in general, because there's a number of retailers who have said, why should I order, if I usually order like 100 issues of one of these $10 Detective or Action 1000s, or the most recent Wonder Woman 750, the upcoming Flash 750, why should I order 100 of those when I know I'm going to sell 25 off the shelf, and those other 75 I was hoping I would get as interested shelf sales? People are just going to say, well, if I'm going to pay 10, I might as well pay 25 and get this exclusive variant that I can only get from Adam Hughes or J. Scott Campbell over here, or in the case of Torpedo Comics with Wonder Woman, after FOC was completed, they put out a three-cover set, and not like a sketch, a color, and a virgin. It was three completely different connecting covers done by Jim Lee, who was promoting them via Twitter and other social media, to most of retailers' frustration, saying, we didn't know we were up against these. We would have changed our orders accordingly. So DC just has so many problems going on right now that it's unfortunately indicative of what we see on the lists. Things sell because, as we've talked about before, by and large, not everyone, but by and large, comic readers are creatures of massive habit. And that's both good and bad. But once you get to a point where you've gone beyond reasonable expectation, that habit diminishes and disappears. Sam's an example of that. John, you're an example of that. I'm an example of that. I was willing to stick out Nightwing through a writer that I didn't really enjoy. But once I didn't enjoy the writing, I didn't enjoy the fact that it became Rick Grayson. There was enough things that compounded that I just said, you know what? As bad as my habit is, I'm willing to kick this one. And I still carry on buying other books. And so it just shifted my dollars from one publisher to another.
Well, what surprises me about all of that is, I mean, I agree that DC has some major story problems, but they always historically had been a better supporter of the retail community. And it feels like with the three triptych Jim Lee covers and stuff like that, they've almost abandoned that practice.
Yeah, they really have. And it's not good.
Yeah, because I can see where not only does that make it hard to compete with those kinds of sales and stuff, but unsurprisingly, it's just, I don't know, for them to promote it that way and stuff on Twitter and stuff and basically drive sales away from a lot of retailers seems very counterproductive.
Yeah, I mean, like we expect that J. Scott Campbell is going to be doing that with Marvel books. It's an expectation that we have because we know that practice. But we also know that ahead of FOC, because he's got it posted in his store, and it's become repeatable enough that we can expect it and understand it. When your co-publisher and chief creative officer is all of a sudden doing covers for a private company, which fine, they're paying for them, and then promoting them, there's like a conflict of interest there, because not only is he doing what he wants for the... He's doing what he wants as an artist. He's doing what he wants, you know, sell books as a publisher. It just doesn't feel right. And that's just one example.
Well, it feels like as a publisher, he's picking favorites between the retailers.
Right. And it's, you know, I think the bigger problem was, had all the retailers known that we were up against this cover, it would have adjusted our orders accordingly. But instead, people feel like they were kind of cheated in this instance, where they knew that they were going to be books as soon as FOC had passed, and that social media post came out Tuesday directly after FOC, people knew that, oh, my sales are going to, I'm going to take a hit because I have buyers that will buy those over what I have. So yeah, there's that. There's everything from Doomsday Clock having final prints instead of just going back to print if demand was there. There's so much going on that it can't help but be shown both from a consumer standpoint and a retailer standpoint, right? Retailers aren't going to put money in a place where it's either doomed to fail or there's an excessive amount of frustration. I'm sorry, if you run a comic store, or at least if you're running our comic store, we have way more than just comics. And John, you've been here and you've seen, you know, it's a bigger store than what many are.
Yeah.
We've got a lot of lines of product, and why should we waste 50% or more of our energy on one publisher's practices when we can just, you know, here's my number, I'll add three Batman to sell off the shelf. If I sell out, good. If I don't, it's not that big of an issue. Not going deep on anything else. That's the way we're going to do it, because we're going to hedge our bets to put our energy and our effort where it best fits.
Yeah, I think you have to operate that way. And I think it comes down to DC's bench of properties out there right now, looking again at the top 500 comics for the year. If we filter out the kind of one-shots and titles that have just completed, it really, I think, gets to be a fairly short list. I'm just doing a couple of that sort of filtering right now, and really, the majority of it is either Batman or Justice League or Detective. Once we take those couple of titles out, I'm curious if we're going to have almost anything left. And it comes down to, I expect those titles to do better than the other stuff.
Right.
But not to the point of there being, 55 items left if you take that out. And it comes down to Batman, Superman, Young Justice, Flash, Superman, a few issues of Legion, I think, one issue of Shazam, although I'm sure more came out that year. There's not much. I mean, you expect Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman to be the kind of the anchor characters. So what do they have to bank on other than those things?
Right.
I'm filtering it a little bit more to take those particular titles out.
Yeah, I mean, I whittled it down to events and anything not Batman centric. So I took out all the Batman titles, detective titles, left Catwoman in.
Yeah.
Took Dark Knight Returns out. Deceased I left in, and Deceased A Good Day to Die. Took Detective out, left Doomsday in. Event Leviathan.
I took Doomsday and Deceased out on the grounds that they're over. They're not going to repeat in 2020.
Yeah. Well, and Heroes in Crisis. But for me, the big thing is I'm looking at it, and I mean, it's either event stuff or Batman. And then it's not until you get down into the about the 200 range that you start seeing a pattern of non-Batman stuff where Justice League is in there, Event Leviathan is in there, and you got some Green Lantern. It's pretty much just Justice League. I mean, it's not good.
Yeah.
Marvel's not much different. It's all X-Men, Spider-Man, and number ones with a million variants.
I would claim foul on that because there's Immortal Hulk. I would say you've got Venom, you've got Carnage.
That's all Spider-Man.
To me, it's not quite the same.
It's as much Spider-Man as Catwoman is Batman to me.
Yeah. I would say, well, you've got a lot of Spider-Man family titles. I would say the Carnage, Venom, Black Cat. They're at least starring a different character, which would be if what we're seeing on DC is, hey, we've got Nightwing, we've got Robin, we've got a Batwing or Catwoman or Harley or something like that. Okay, they're at least different characters, even if it's one family of titles. With DC, I'm seeing so much of it being literally the Bruce Wayne Batman that's the cause for concern. I think the other difference is with the X-Men stuff, you've got not just X-Men, you've got New Mutants, you've got X-Force, Excalibur, and a few things like that. So they've got a couple of strong families of titles, whereas I don't feel DC does. If for some reason they couldn't publish Batman, which obviously isn't going to be the case, but if it were, what else do they got? Whereas we've seen times where Marvel decides, you know what, we're going to downplay the X-Men. We're going to, you know, focus on this, you know, the Inhumans or something. So I think it's a little bit different, but I see where you're coming from.
Yeah.
Give me a second.
For you, Sam, two, being generous with my seconds.
I'll give you the Immortal Hulk at rank 60, number 16. But other than that, it's anything that's not a number one is House of X, Powers of X, and Spider-Man, and number ones. I mean, Marvel, if it's not a number one, it doesn't sell either, unless it's Amazing Spider-Man.
I'm going to filter out number ones, number 1000s. I'm also going to take out House of X, Powers of X, because I think those are
okay.
One-off kind of, you're not going to be able to pull that kind of a thing every year. What I'm seeing is X-Men, Amazing Spider-Man, Absolute Carnage, which was an event, a fair number of Immortal Hulks, Venom, War of the Realms, another event sort of a thing, going a little further down. Wow, a lot of Amazing Spider-Man and Venom.
Yeah, exactly. You got Spider-Man, X-Men, and number ones.
So I took out...
I filtered number ones out.
I know.
And,
I'm just...
And I took out Amazing. Yeah, I see Absolute Carnage, Immortal Hulk, Venom. You've got, what, War of the Realms 2 and 3 right at the 100-106 mark. Another Immortal Hulk, more War of the Realms. Venom, Venom, Venom.
But we also got a few things like an occasional Captain Marvel, Return of Wolverine, Fantastic Four, Savage Avengers...
Well, where are you? Because
I'm getting down to around
150-ish. Yeah, 150 to okay. 200. I mean, there's a. I think just looking at this list after we filter out Amazing and the X titles and stuff like that, I think you guys would agree with me. If there's one Marvel title that probably shocked the industry and deserves a lot of praise, it's Immortal Hulk. I mean,
yeah,
it is littering the list. I'm gonna, yeah. So hats off to Al Ewing. It was clearly one of the kings for Marvel itself. I'm just filtering to Immortal Hulk, and it had
18 items on it.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
Like every issue released that year, probably.
Yeah.
And 13 of them were in the top 300 for the year. I mean, so you're, and the low water mark was issue 26, which might be the most recent one to come out.
No, 28 is.
Yes, you are correct. 28. And that's the low watermark is 45,448. I don't think anyone would have predicted that with a Hulk title, let alone not a standard Hulk title, a more of the original monster Immortal Hulk style. So
I mean, to Sam's point, Marvel is definitely leaning on a few key properties, X-Men chief among them at the moment, but I don't think they're as singularly focused as DC is, but I think they also just do a better job managing their stable of characters and their library of titles. I don't see other areas kind of faltering when they do something like House of X, Powers of X. It's not like suddenly the Avengers franchise cratered or something like that. And I'm just not seeing that sort of strong franchise over at DC, whereas I'm seeing one or two particular strong titles over at DC.
Yeah, I will say from a Marvel standpoint, there is one, well, there's probably a couple, but one title to me that has really underproduced for the year, and I think it's a problem, is Captain America. There are only two issues of Captain America on the top 500. Neither of them are in the top 300. In fact, it's number quantity ranked 399 and 414, and that's issues 12 and 7, respectively. I think as a linchpin character in the Avengers, as a character that was front and center for the first, you know, large story arc of the Avengers film franchise with Marvel, to have it only place two comics in the top 500 for the year, I think that's a little bit of a problem. I think that's something Marvel has to work on, and I don't think it's something that can necessarily be all resolved with variant covers. Cap is a very important character in the Marvel universe, and I think this was a down year for him.
There was only one issue of Tony Stark Iron Man in the list, and it was ranked 344.
Oh, that's a great point, too. However, I guess for me, I respect Iron Man. I very much like Iron Man, but I hold Captain America in a little bit higher esteem. He's kind of like the, I guess as Superman is to Batman, Captain America to me is to Spider-Man. Like, he's kind of that other linchpin.
No, and I get that. I certainly think Captain America is, from a nature of the universe point of view, the linchpin that Superman is for DC, kind of the personification of all that is right and good in the world or whatever.
Right.
I was just thinking in terms of key characters from the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Thor, Cap, and Iron Man. And Cap and Iron Man poorly represented on this list, whereas Thor did decently.
Yeah.
I mean, only one of them in the top 300 with King Thor number one, but there was another, you know, nine items or whatever between issue two of King Thor and a couple issues of Thor.
Right, right.
I'm just thinking if somebody were to go watch, you know, Endgame or something and say, you know, I got to go read these comics, those seem like the kinds of characters they would have started with.
Right. And I mean, it is indicative as well when someone who's watched the movies comes in and asks what to read. Captain America is one of those characters where we are more prone to say, you know, what was your favorite movie with Cap in it? And usually people have tended to say Winter Soldier. And so we'll take them right over to the trade section and hand them the Ed Brubaker Winter Soldier trade. I mean, that is kind of a, I don't want to say evergreen, but it is one of those Cap titles that is just always a proven steady seller. And there's, you know, Spider-Man tends to get top creative billing almost all the time. You've got standard Spider-Man, you've got Miles Morales. So you've got enough there that there's always something fresh and new and restarting. But with some of these titles, Tony Stark has been a hard sell. Just Iron Man in general has been a hard sell because over the last handful of years, it's gone through so many different iterations. It's gone through so many different title names, title characters. We had Riri, and it went from Iron Man to Iron Heart. And it just, that one has been kind of a rough journey to follow as a retailer, let alone as a reader, I would assume. So, and admittedly, Iron Man is not one of the books that I page through. I have limited time, and that's not one that I'm able to consume. But that's been a character, I think, that has just seen so much turnover in its own title run that it's kind of played out this way. Whereas Cap is Cap, Captain America. And that's, you know, for me, where there's a struggle.
Ultimately, those two were the last two affected majorly by the replacement heroes, and they still haven't recovered. Cap, not only was he Falcon for a long time, when they brought him back, whether it's the way the story played out or not, what the non-comic reading public all heard is, those crazy guys over at Marvel turned him into a Nazi.
Yeah, I think that did some Secret damage. Empire. And also the stories kind of before and after of, is he upset about it? Is he over it? Is he not?
So Captain America, to the non-comic reader for the last, you know, three, 4 years has either been Sam Wilson or a Nazi. They weren't interested. And Iron Man with Riri, you got a similar thing.
But the way you had originally phrased that is Captain America had been Falcon. I really do want to see Steve Rogers as Falcon now. I think that would be hilarious. Next time he ditches the shield and the costume for a bit, which he might be actually be doing now in this book, that would be funny. But I think part of it is there has been a rejection of the status quo over at Marvel, which is something I've railed on DC for doing a lot. But again, as much as I like the Jane Foster as Thor and stuff, you're coming from the movies, you're not going to recognize that character. You know, I think what they did both with Winter Soldier and Sam Wilson and stuff as Cap was fun. It's not Steve Rogers. You get him back and now he doesn't want to be Cap again kind of a thing. It's like, what's up with this? You know, this is not what people mean when they say reluctant hero.
Right. If he doesn't want to be Cap, why should I want to read Cap?
Yeah. Yeah. If the character doesn't care about the title, why should I? Yeah. I think that's...
That's been one of the biggest knocks on Detective Comics that we hear month in and month out. When are they actually going to solve some? When's Batman going to solve a crime? When's he actually going to be the best detective? And that's, we have our regulars that buy the book, but those that used to buy the book, and that's how they look at Batman, that's what they say. I'll be back on when Batman is solving crimes like a detective again.
Yeah, yeah.
And I can't fault them for that.
No, me neither. I mean, that's an expectation set by the title.
Right.
I think they've lost sight at times, particularly characters that have multiple books, as to what is the identity of each book. You know, at one point, you know, Action Comics was literally the more action aspect of Superman or whatever, versus Superman was more about the man or something. Maybe you'd find a little bit more of the Clark Kent type stories there or something like that. You know, with Batman, again, if you're going to do mystery and detective stories, Detective Comics seems like the logical place to go do that. But at this point, it's just, you know, it's a Batman feature title. We can tell any story in any title, and it makes it harder to remember which story happened in which book, and harder to know which book to go buy, depending on what kinds of stories you want of these characters. For something as brand aware as the comic medium tends to be, they've lost sight of that in how they're creating the books at times. And it just, it stuns me. I don't get it.
So one thing that I just did to kind of flip the script and look a little bit onto the positive side, which could also be a negative, I guess, how you want to look at it, but I went over to DC and I looked at the prestige format Black Label books. So I didn't count the Batman White Knight or the Snyder Darkverse Batman stuff. I just looked at Batman Dam, Joker, Harley, Criminal Sanity, Harleen, and Joker Killer Smile. And yes, there's a couple number ones in there, but we also have the number twos and number threes. And I think that all of them are in the top 300. I don't think that. I know that. I'm looking at it. But I think that having sales over 50,000 for all of them is a good thing. And I think it just shows that maybe DC Editorial should take note, because these creators that are writing these stories and the artists that are obviously working with them have their passion behind them. You guys being John, you and James talked about Harleen just glowingly. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed the entire story of Batman Damned. I read it in singles as it came out, and then when the collected hardcover came out, I read the whole thing again. And I mean, these are great stories. With a little bit of tuning and tweaking, they wouldn't be any more, I guess, mature than a lot of what's out there right now coming out of the dark Batman kind of brooding world that we're in. But I just look at it and I think, you know, the editorial needs to stand up and take notice and say, okay, there's creators out there that have good, solid ideas that can tell stories really well. What are we doing that's getting in the way and preventing them from wanting to take on the core title? And again, seeing the sales over 50,000 for all of these issues, all the way up to 118,000 for Batman Dam 3, you know, everything from $5.99 to $7.99 at the price point, people want it, people are reading it, people like it. And I think it's a good thing for DC. They've got great names working on these things, and I hope that they continue to put out this quality product with, you know, top level creative talent like they do have.
I certainly hope so. I would like it to be the norm on their titles, regardless if it's Black Label or not.
Well, I would agree there, and we can go back to the negative and say, is it a label? Is it what is it? Because we've got DC, we lost DC Inc. and DC Zoom to DC Kids. And then we had Black Label come. We decided to get rid of, oh my gosh, mind blank, Vertigo. And that is supposedly the replacement for the mature titles. And then we've got pop-up brands like the Young Animal imprint, which apparently still is in existence, even though books aren't coming out. And then you've
Doom Patrol?
It's been a while.
Okay.
And then
I don't remember if it finished or not, but yeah.
And then you've got the Hill House
books.
And
then Wonder Comics.
However, Wonder Comics is a pop-up brand that's actually more of an imprint because it has ongoings, whereas Hill House is a pop-up brand, but it's actually also part of Black Label. It's just a whole back to that whole DC doesn't even know what they're doing business. So it's a little confusing, but carry on with the magazine-style prestige format books, please, DC. They work.
I've considered adding imprint to my data cleaning process to where it could pull out things like the Wonder Comics line and stuff like that fairly easily. Do you think that is worth doing?
So it would do like Wonder and Black Label for DC. It would do Skybound, Top Cow.
Potentially. I'd have to go, as I identify each title and stuff, have to go key that in.
Hmm.
But something to where we could easily filter the list to the Wonder Comics stuff without having to just, you know, pick the individual titles off the list.
I mean, if I don't know if you would be able, it might be more work than it's worth because, like I said, in the case of the Hill House books, Hill House books have been doing quite well for us, but are they counted as Hill House or are they counted as Black Label? Because if I want, you know, the data might not be clean enough to make it worth your effort, is what I guess what I'm saying.
The data doesn't exist for this, is my point. I would be hand doing it, so it would be how I decided it was.
Well, there we go.
So I've got the mechanisms in place. I just don't really use it because it's hard enough to go identify, hey, this is a new run of whatever title, much less to remember to tag it the right way. I try to avoid things in my process that require a little too much manual intervention because it's easy to either mess up or get wrong.
Yep.
But I would like to be able to pull out things like the Star Wars titles and some of those things just to see how they would stack up to other, you know, to publishers and other things like that.
I would almost think if there's a way to do, like, families, at least for the big two, that would be even better. Like, you know, the Star Wars stuff for Marvel, the Spider-Man stuff, and then for DC, you've got your Batmans and Wonder Comics, if that can be. I don't know if it's possible to split it out that well, but something like that would be useful, yes.
It is, but then where do you get, because, like, you'd have Batman as one family of titles, Superman as another family of titles. Where do you put Batman Superman?
In the bin.
Yeah, it's just, I think there are different ways to group these titles and look at this stuff to kind of figure out what's happening and why things are happening.
Yeah.
And I think, again, grouping the titles makes sense. I just need to figure out some better ways to do it. But certainly, I mean, it'd be nice to corral all the X-Men franchise books versus the Spider-Man franchise and stuff like that. If I had information on who the editors were electronically as part of the data feed, I'd be happy just to go to editorial office, because 9 times out of 10, that would align close enough.
True.
And I'd love to find out which editors are doing better than other editors, because I've already got that going for the writers and the artists in the new prototype type stuff. And, you know, from a writer point of view, Hickman had a great year with closing in on 2.5 million units across a ton of books, predominantly House of X, Powers of X, X-Men, New Mutants, and stuff. And Tom King wasn't too far behind, mainly on the strength of Batman with some of the Heroes in Crisis stuff tossed in there as well. But it took him 29 items versus the 17 it took Hickman.
Right.
And then also over 2 million units is Nick Spencer with 28 items, all of which were Amazing Spider-Man issues. In my number crunching, I split out the Hunted issues because the way they did the, you know, 20.hu or something like that, it was easier to treat that as a separate title. It was just numbered weird.
Yeah. Do we want to go through some of these top comic writers, or do we want to keep going through some of the issues by other publishers? Because there's two different conversations we can have, and I'm down for either one.
I'm good either way. What do you guys want to talk about?
Why don't we go to some of the other publishers?
Okay. So let's filter Marvel and DC off the list. And obviously, that'll cut the thing down substantially. And really, at the top of the list, unsurprisingly, is a lot of Image stuff. Spawn, Walking Dead, Undiscovered Country near the top there.
I just can't help but think that this isn't a good showing for Image.
Well, let's see. Given that Walking Dead has ended and won't repeat for 2020, yeah, that cuts a number of things off the list for them. Spawn was a high point on the build up to 300 and then started arcing back down, unsurprisingly, but still isn't doing poorly.
Saga on hiatus.
Saga's on hiatus. Undiscovered Country number one did well, but...
That sold really well for a couple reasons. I think there were four or five covers or more. And then on top of it, it was optioned before we even hit FOC. So spec folks hit quick and hard on that. And just a note on Saga, for those of you that were under the impression that it was a one-year hiatus for Fiona to kind of get her art chops back in order, I think it's going to be an indefinite pause as Brian K. Vaughan has three active media properties going on right now. So I would say that 1 year, that is now almost a year and a half, hedging on 2 years hiatus, is probably just going to be an indefinite pause for the time being.
That's unfortunate.
It is. But hey, if I get my Why the Last Man TV show and it's good, I may forgive him. Maybe.
Yeah, I just think it's not going to help Image's sales, but that's their problem.
No, in which we had a good discussion on that before about how, you know, the loss of sales, does it hurt Image as a company? Not necessarily as much directly, because a lot of the costs are just a pass through for printing and stuff like that, and the Image eye. But as I sit and I think about it, I think it does hurt a little, in that without Walking Dead, without Saga, and with Spawn, like you said, peaked and now kind of going a little bit back down to its more normal resting point, there really isn't a big tentpole, lightning rod, exciting month in and month out book at Image that attracts people's eyes.
No pun intended.
No pun intended, honestly. So I think that is a little bit of an issue for Image. There was, I think, a discussion with one of the Image, I don't know if it was editorial or who it was, talking about how they may look at abandoning a lot of single issue stuff and just focusing more on trades. And, you know, I've said
it, Stevenson.
Yeah. And I've said it before and I'll say it again. Their biggest problem is they seem a little liberal with what they're willing to print. And it just results in duplicative titles, similar ideas, similar named things. It just causes confusion and a little bit of apathy, because why should I buy this title if there's going to be three more in the next 3 months that are the same thing? So,
yeah, they don't manage their line very well on the Image Central stuff and try to avoid kind of duplication of concept or theme or something.
Right.
And I get that's hard to do, but I think they should.
Right.
But arguably, that's been one of their biggest problems for the better part of 10 years. I mean, say what you want. It's interesting looking at this list. Everything on it, Spawn and Walking Dead, it's the two things that stuck around. This, oh, I'll try this for two or three issues and forget about it. Oh, I'll try this for two or three issues and forget about it. Oh, I'll try this for two. At some point, the spec people that all were looking to buy the next screenplay gave up, and nobody actually wants to read this because it's got no staying power.
But yeah, I mean, the only thing on Image is Spawn, Walking Dead, and the one issue of Undiscovered Country.
Yep.
One.
The second of which sold low enough to not make the top 500 here.
Exactly.
And Walking Dead's over.
Well, yeah, Walking Dead's over. But again, it's the stuff that's got some consistency to it. And Image has been terrible with their consistency. I don't think most Image books ever, a fifth issue ever comes out on.
I question if they should be consistent, because they've gone through periods where they've had runs that could go for, you know, 20, 30 issues or something. The majority of them, yeah, are miniseries at best, a series of miniseries. But I think a lot of what I see of people who are heavy on Image, they want something new and different every month. And
yeah, but that crowd seems to be dying.
True.
When they thought the next big hit was right out there, were they heavy on something new every month, or were they heavy on a new spec every month?
Probably on a new spec.
And they realized there's no such thing.
But even things that lasted like 50 issues, like Morning Glories and stuff, I'm sure there are a lot of people who are like, what's that? You know, because it's gone and forgotten about.
Yeah, and what we've seen in the last couple of years is the trend, as far as a speculator standpoint, is that the Image properties really aren't hit as heavily as speculator items as they used to be. Mostly because when your first issue sells in the 25,000 to 50,000 range, there's more than enough copies out there. It's the small publishers that have things that are coming out in the 1,500 to maybe 6,000 range, that that's where the spec hits really are, or things like Something's Killing the Children, Once in Future, that even though they had big numbers, 40,000 or so on their first issues, they sold themselves just based on the content and the excitement of the story. So really, we're just not seeing as much of the spec move on Image as we used to. And if you think about people wanting to buy, you know, your Spawns and your variant covers for the 300 and 301 issues, that's great. But the numbers show themselves. There's, 275,000 copies of 300 and 190,000 copies of 301. So right there, you've got close to 365,000 copies, or 465,000 copies of just those two issues. The speculator hit on those is just not going to last.
Well, by 302, it's down to 53,472 units.
Right. It's just one of those things where Image isn't the big spec hit that it used to be. There's some people that still treat and act as though it is, but what we see from a long-term game is that it's just not there. It doesn't hold. Now, you get some of those Spawn issues in the 180s. Those are low print run, and those still have high value. But again, print run matters in most cases, especially with modern books.
Well, if we take Image off the list, so we've taken our three big publishers off, the only thing left in the top 500 comics, and we've got stuff sprinkled below because of the extended radar for the indie books, but the only thing left in the top 500 is Vampirella, number 1, Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number 100, Power Rangers Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, number 1, Vengeance of Vampirella, number 1, Bloodshot, number 1, Something is Killing the Children, number 1, and Once in Future, number 1. So you take out the number 1s in the milestone issue for TMNT, you ain't got nothing left. So it's a competitive market, and it's not just that we're not seeing anything big from Image, we're really just not seeing anything big from any of the other publishers, which isn't shocking to me.
I think just looking beyond the top 500 at the list that we've got, the only thing that is consistently hitting this list with higher numbers is Rick and Morty. And I'm looking at the summary Mayo Report data top comics for year tab, and I'm seeing once you get outside the top 500, and if you just look at Rick and Morty, I think there's, issues 45 through 52, something like that. I'm trying to whittle it down. I'm just going off of the full list that's in front of me here.
You've also got the D&D Painscape ones.
Yeah, there's a couple of other one-shots, I think, on there. But there's a total of 12 issues of Rick and Morty-type stuff between ranks, 1377 and 2304. Now, the way this works is after the top 500, we get a sprinkling of data because they give the top so many, I forget how many, items from indie publishers just to give them some representation on the list, because otherwise, I mean, it's just going to be, again, mainly the couple of big premier publishers. Give me a minute and I will pull up the raw data itself and see how deep that list was, because I don't remember quite how far down that went.
So while you're doing that, I'm just going to say, for whatever reason, my list is a little bit different. I have 13 Rick and Morty items from issues 45 to 57. And those comprised of a sum total of 131,621. So 13 issues in a year that are basically the only thing over number ones from the smaller premier and non-premier publishers. And again, minus maybe a handful of issue 2 and 3s here and there. But 13 items, total sales summed up to 131,621 units moved. That's not a lot compared to some of the other books that we're looking at. So that back half, there's a lot of smaller publishers that have low numbers. I mean, 130, that number would place, if you were to add all those up, it would be the 26th ranking item. So every Rick and Morty issue sold to retailers for the year would place the entire title at 26th on the list.
And again, I realize it's a smaller thing, but since we are kind of talking about these, I think it is fair to mention the first six issues of The Goon also made the list.
It is, and...
And that's quite an accomplishment for... why can I not think of his name?
Oh, Eric Powell.
Mr. Powell, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, and his sum total for those is 55,000.
Yep.
So, in addition to the top 500, we got the top 100 indie comics a couple of which were within the top 500, and then I just added the other stuff to the list. So this is where we start jumping around in rankings after number 500. So we get to see how all these other publishers are kind of doing, even though they're not within the radar of the top 500 items, which is good, and it gives us a good vantage point on that stuff. I mean, there's a fair amount of Red Sonja showing up here, some Vampirella, but again, all of these things are you know, a drop in the bucket compared to how the top 500 is doing, because these, I'm going to say 97 or so items is about a 1.3 million units, versus if we look at the top 500, we get a sum total of 34 million units. But it's one of those things where I think these smaller publishers, you know, they're a good way to expand the comic reading audience, because you can fill a lot of kind of niche interests and stuff that just isn't going to get filled by, you know, the big publishers. But they've got to do it on a much more cost-effective manner, because they're just not going to get the sales.
And I think it's fair to note that a decent amount of these real small publishers, like Eric Powell, is a great example. He is a regular at, you know, the con circuit, and he's always got his books there to sell. And I would venture to guess he probably sells double to triple at conventions what he's selling through Diamond. And part of that is just because people go and know him. Now, there's some creators Absolutely. That's not the case, but that's, and I think, John, you often point to that. This is what sells into stores. It's a barometer for the market, but not the total sum answer.
Well, and I think convention sales are going to vary a lot from publisher to publisher, but also creator to creator. There are some creators that I know have a really solid presence at, like, Comic-Con and other conventions, but they're there to do sketches. They're there to meet and talk with the fans and stuff like that. They're not there, you know, trying to sell every comic they've ever done. Whereas there are others where, man, they are hustling like you wouldn't believe, and they've got all their stuff there. You want it, they'll sell it to you.
Right.
And neither is a right or wrong approach. They're just different attitudes, you know. And I think what you get out of the convention sales experience as a creator really depends what you put into it.
I agree 100%.
I've seen some that are these creators are doing good to break even on their table and stuff. Others are doing some decent business. So, and some people are just more predisposed to work that kind of way than others.
To be fair, I think some of the publishers are in the same boat.
It just doesn't seem like we're seeing any really strong, other than the one or two obvious, you know, Batman, X-Men type stuff, strong either franchises or titles or kind of breakaway hits.
Yeah, and I think what you were talking about with creators and the way they treat conventions, I think there are a couple of publishers that are in a similar situation. The guys at Zenoscope come to mind. Those guys work and sell and sell and seem to be at every convention known to man. Yeah, I think they probably sell a lot more at those conventions than you will ever see on these lists.
Well, I would think so. I definitely think they've got a stronger presence and are there to sell. Likewise, when I see them at conventions, Antarctic Press has a ton of their properties and creators and stuff out there and have a strong presence. So I think they might do better than expected.
I think Aftershock and Valiant are also examples of that as publishers. Now, Valiant has gone away from doing a lot of booths, and they just kind of roam the floor speaking with people, mostly with retailers and vendors. But Aftershock, they've always have a really good presence with a number of people staffing their booth, and they've seen significant gains, in my opinion, at conventions just with straight-up table sales.
And Boom. I think they do pretty well on that stuff.
Boom has just really, I mean, to me, they're the retailer of the year. They were promoted to premier publisher, you know, not that long ago with Dynamite, and they continue to put tool after tool in the retailer box to allow us to, as they say, find our ceiling. They allow us to order, you know, with their Boom guarantee for retailers for issue ones and a lot of issue twos. They really let you reach and find your ceiling. It's kind of a good faith. After the affidavit comes out, we don't have to strip covers or send full books back. It's an act of good faith, and they really let you kind of determine where your numbers are. And then on top of it, it was announced in the Diamond Boom mailer today to retailers that some of their trades that are going out are going to be comic shop only for the first 3 months before they are allowed to be sold through Amazon or Barnes & Noble, brick and mortar bookstores, things like that. So there's just a lot of pieces that they're putting into place that really empower the retailer to have that first opportunity. And from speaking with Boom, both their publisher and their retailer sales, I guess, inside sales, whatever you want to call them, representative, their vision is that the comic store really is the first and main avenue to sell their product. They don't have, you know, a massive video arm that's making feature films and things like that. They are more of a boutique publisher. They're, you know, creator owned in many cases. And what they really want to focus on is just what tools can we give retailers to maximize their ability to sell? And they're doing that, and it's showing. They're getting top creative talent. They're getting books that are constantly selling out, going back to reprints. I think Something is Killing the Children, number one, went to sixth or seventh print of the first issue. I mean, it's just they're very successful. They're seeing a ton of success.
Well, they're also going where the readers are. When I went to Power Morphicon Express in Houston, which was a tiny convention, literally it was in an event center that was a glorified gymnasium. They were there. Or at least there was a booth for Boom. Whether there was anyone who physically worked in the Boom office or not, they had their comics. They had the small comic box with the Power Rangers stuff on it and stuff. I mean, they had a solid presence there because they had the property. They knew this convention was going out there. Hopefully they made money on it. But the bottom line is the fans were happy both that they were there and how they'd been treating the property that they like.
Right.
So there's a lot to be said for just garnering that kind of goodwill.
Yep.
It's a shame the other publishers don't all do that.
And that's not to say that other publishers don't do that. It's just for me, in 2019 as a retailer, Boom really stepped it up. And they're continuing to push other publishers to find new ways to be a player in the marketplace and to find and challenge them to raise numbers and give retailers tools to use.
Well, it just seems like what you're talking about of them, you know, keeping stuff comic store exclusive for a few months is diametrically opposed to the story you were telling of, you know, right after the FOC, Jim Lee saying, oh, yeah, and I'm doing these three covers for this one retailer.
Right, right. I mean, even Marvel gives us our opportunities by doing retailer exclusive direct market covers that feature better art than what the standard art covers are for their omnibuses, for some of their like the House of X, Powers of X. The direct market cover was the Mark Brooks connecting variant. Beautiful cover. We actually had people coming into the store saying, I saw this cover online. Amazon doesn't have it. Barnes & Noble doesn't have it. Do you know where I can get it? And that was one that we ordered plenty of extras of the direct market. And we were able to say, yeah, we've got it over there on the shelf, and we've only got a couple of copies left. So, I mean, it's things like that that they really do give you a boost.
No, it's smart to do that. I mean, I really do think these publishers need to partner better with the retail community. And I think it goes in both directions in terms of giving retailers what they need to succeed, but also learning from the retailers what's working and what's not, and then acting on that.
Right.
And it just, to me, that seems like common sense. It just doesn't seem like it always happens.
No, it does not always happen.
Well, yes and no, though. Ultimately, the comic direct market is small. You know, I don't know what it did, but, you know, and it could be way off. It could be a fifth. But it could also, even one of those top books we're talking about, those trades, that Powers of X thing, there's a chance Amazon's initial order was two or three times the direct market combined.
Well, let's be careful what we're talking about here.
Okay.
There's the trade market and there's the comic market. For the trade stuff, I absolutely agree that outside the direct market is huge for trades, for particular trades. House of X, Powers of X, probably a great example. On the comic book individual issue side, I really challenge that assertion.
I agree, but, and this is the place I know I give DC credit and retailers hate it. They've tried, and the retailers have screamed about it every time. Retailers don't want to see comics expanded, really.
I do.
I just think they don't want to see it to where it's expanded away from them. If it's expanded that they're included in, that's cool.
Right. And I'm not saying that everything has to be exclusive to comic stores X, Y, and Z. It just let us do fair business with the, you know, the hand that we're dealt. Not that we're owed anything, but at the same time, when DC's in the crapper, we're the ones propping them up. I can tell you Amazon could give two rips if DC's in the crapper, because they're still going to sell Watchmen, they're still going to sell Killing Joke, and they don't care if they're going to sell a recent comic. But we as the retail store are the front to the main culture, and we're going to be there to continue to promote, help, and move their stories. Now, we could just say we don't care and just literally not care. DC's going to fail, and if they fail in our area, they're not going to be able to, in many cases, pay for their single-issue content of things like Metal Men, Sideways, you name it. They're not going to be able to cover the cost of that, so they're not going to publish it. They're not going to put it out. They're not going to have anything new. It's just going to make things worse. So while we as retailers, many retailers, will give off an air of, you owe us, it's business, all right? I'm not blind to that. It's business. But you have to think of who keeps supplying the butter for the bread is really the comic retail outlets. When things are bad, we're still there, right? Sales on Amazon go up and down. They'll sell Tide Pods to my wife. They'll sell tennis shoes to me. They're not dependent on single issues doing anything for them. So it's really one of those things where we really need to at least be respected for what we do for the industry, and that is keep people interested into the stories, moving the product. And again, Amazon and the trade market, Barnes & Noble, fine. They're going to have their place, and we get that. That's the price of doing business. We understand it. If you're a retailer in the graphic novel and comic industry and you don't accept that, you probably shouldn't be in the business. So that's just my take on it. There's times where Amazon has had to bail us out because Diamond's out of product and we've had to order it through Amazon so we could have a copy on the shelf. It sucks, but it works. Sometimes that's what you have to do.
Well, there's definitely a place for, you know, Amazon, other parts of the mass market and stuff, as there is for the direct market. But in terms of individual comic book issues, we're talking around $336 million retail dollars of product that got moved in the direct market, or in, whether it moved to consumers is another question, but got moved out to those retail stores just for the top 300 comics every month of the year. That's a decent amount. I don't know of anywhere else outside of the direct market anything close to that is happening in terms of individual comic book issues.
But I think that is where that data breach from a few months ago came in vital, is when we saw just how few retailers are at the very top of that list, and basically their mass market outlets. They're the big, for the most part, online nationwide presence, which means if you can get someone like Amazon on board, they can replace the entire direct market.
In theory, they could, but it's, you can't go to an Amazon store and look at the product. And a lot of the product moves based on visual and tactile touching. If you're talking digital, yes, of course.
But that list that we saw proved that wasn't the case. Look at who was at the top of that list. It wasn't necessarily places that were moving it all tactile, hand-to-hand. It was mail-order companies.
I get, well, one in particular, and the other one is a retail location in, what, the second largest city in the United States that has three locations in the Marvel mail order. But the thing that I'm going to say is that the one that was at the top of the list does not equal the entire market. And so if you cut out literally everything underneath that, that's still a big hit.
But it wasn't just the top two. It was, if you looked at the top 10, there was four of the big mail order houses on it. And again, that could, in theory, be replaced fairly easily by one of the mass retailers. You know,
I would argue it could not be, in so much as at least one of those mass retailers of Amazon's been around well over 20 years and hadn't done it yet.
Well, the question is why?
Not worth their time.
Exactly.
Because this is not mass market material. This is something where a niche direct market is able to sell it, which even though you have some people that are large players in that market, it's still, I would not consider any of those mass market type locations.
Okay, that becomes a very interesting argument. So, but if I'm a publisher, seriously, if I'm a publisher, is my goal to cater to that direct market, or is it try to figure out how to get into the mass market?
It's neither. It's how to sell the most product however you can.
Yes, I agree with that. And here's where it gets real interesting with the large corporations that own the big two. Those companies have leverage with the mass market resellers. Chances are it'd be tough to get those partners to partner with the comics division. But in theory, if they wanted, they...
So you're suggesting like there'd be a Marvel Comics area in like a Disney store?
Or how about this? Amazon, one of the things they sell a ton of is media, both digital movies and physical Blu-ray. How about if Disney and Warner Brothers said, hey, if you want to get our Blu-rays and streaming movies, otherwise we'll just take them to iTunes and Google. If you want them, you're going to carry our comic books too.
One, I don't know that they could legally do that given their agreement with Diamond.
Well, again, Diamond's a different issue. And that contract's got to end at some point. It can't be indefinite.
I'm going to argue it could and needs to be indefinite. Otherwise, the market collapses. I mean, I get where you're coming from, and I don't conceptually disagree with you, but there's some pragmatic aspects of this that it doesn't work in the same scale that these mass market, be it an Amazon or a big box store like a Walmart or whatever, tend to operate in, because even at what we consider high cover price for the amount of material we're getting, we're talking a couple of bucks worth of you know, cover price per item.
Sure.
It's not profitable enough.
But again, you look at the big online retailers, the Walmarts, the Amazons, those companies, and look at how many small dollar items they do flush through their system just to keep people shopping there and using it as an exclusive shopping. And, you know, batteries have no margin either. Amazon is the largest seller of alkaline batteries by a mile in this country.
Oh, I believe that, but I think there's a fundamental difference between a battery where it really doesn't matter at the end of the day if I get a Duracell or Energizer or whatever, whereas it's a fundamental difference if I get a Spider-Man or a Batman comic.
Yes, but Amazon has Duracell and Energizer and no-name brands and everything else, so why not have Batman and Spider-Man and everyone else as well?
Because you're not talking about one product that's offered by multiple manufacturers. Because of the story is the content, it's not like one movie is interchangeable with any other movie. Just like a comic isn't interchangeable with any other comic.
It isn't. But, and again, look at particularly what Amazon has done with their digital publishing for their Kindle books. Or, again, we're just talking movies. Both digital and physical film media. If you have a large enough percentage of the entire market, you just carry them all. I'm sure there's tons of DVDs on Amazon that don't sell that well. But it doesn't matter. They have become the DVD store for 99% of the country.
True, true.
You carry them all because that's where people come.
Well, because then you're known for the selection, and it's the go-to place to go do it. Why bother looking anywhere else? If Amazon exactly. doesn't have it, who would? But what's interesting is with their buyout of Comixology a couple of years ago, people were thinking we were going to see this seismic change in the industry of digital comics and stuff, and we haven't.
We haven't, except for the most part, they do single-handedly control that market now.
Did they not before?
No, well, Comixology did before.
Right. What has changed, other than the ownership of Comixology, about how Comixology operates, that is a significant game changer simply because the behemoth of Amazon owns them?
Nothing, except that then becomes the same question. What changes when the ownership of the distribution changes from Diamond to Amazon, other than you don't need the resellers?
I don't see that as the same sort of thing, because you're talking about replacing a distributor that works to small businesses with a online store that sells directly to customers.
Yes. And digital now is completely in their control. Why couldn't physical be?
I think it goes back to what Eric was saying. A lot of the stuff people want to get their hands on and see first. People have a hard enough time buying a $3.99 comic when they can see it on the rack and flip through it. They're not going to do it mail order sight unseen. I say that as somebody who's been doing that for over a decade.
And again, as that data breach showed, that's what the vast majority of the market's doing.
Did it really show that? Or just that the larger ones were online stores?
So for me, it just showed that there's one that had, from a Marvel sales standpoint, a significantly larger amount of sales. Now, that's just Marvel. We can make an assumption that it carries across the board with all publishers, but I guess I look at it this way. The people that go to that particular company, by and large, got to start somewhere else. They didn't just stumble on the website and go, I'm just going to start buying things here, right? So they were in a store at some point. They had a friend at some point. They had some way of getting their hands on something before they decided to jump in and get it. Not everyone, but I'm going to wager to guess quite a large percentage. And so the direct market already did its job. It hooked those customers. It got them in. Now you cut the direct market out and you get rid of that, that lifeline to the future is gone. And by the way, I had no clue that Amazon was the largest seller of batteries, and they have a lot of batteries on here.
Yes, they do.
But if anyone is so lazy that they can't go to the gas station or Walmart to get batteries, then Lord help you. Now, if you're physically unable, that's a different story. Anyways.
It is what it is. It's one of those things that I don't think we often understand the volume that things like that can create.
But I also think that volume is one thing. Everyone can still succeed. If you look at Watchmen on Amazon, the Watchmen trade paperback, it's number one in every graphic novel category. It's number 508 in all of books. The 508th best-selling book in all of books. I mean, that's insane. And we still sell copies every month.
Yep.
So if it's done well, if it's a good product, there's enough for everyone to eat. But when you put out crap, it's not there.
Yeah, I think it's a matter I don't think the data breach told us anything we didn't already know, that online retailers have a larger reach than any physical store that people are going to drive to and go shop in person at.
Okay.
Yeah.
And
I was just going to say, there's a couple of retailers that got very loud and outspoken about that and were just clutching their pearls and just aghast at how large a couple of these places were. And I looked at the numbers and I was like, okay, that's not shocking. I mean, you must live in a bubble if you couldn't see these things. So do you not turn on the internet? I mean, I don't get it. I don't know. Man, some point when James and I are out of this business, if anyone's even around to listen, there's a hell of a book to be written, I think.
Of course.
It's just insane.
I'm not saying it's a good thing, but, and I've said this for years, I don't think the direct market, from the distributors to the publishers to the resellers to the customers, have necessarily always been the best thing for comics either. I don't think they've helped themselves in a lot of ways.
I agree with that.
100% with that, even to this day.
Exactly.
Yes.
But I think they were a necessary survival mechanism for the industry.
And if you look for a while, we were the only survival mechanism. When the newsstand disappeared, they disappeared out of grocery stores, and before Amazon and your DCBS and your Midtowns Online, before the internet, it was all based on direct market. And I'm not saying that that means that the publishers owe us. It just means that we've been there thick and thin. We are a lifeblood for the industry, and we need to at least be along for the journey and not getting it after the fact and kind of treat it as a second-class citizen, so to speak.
Well, and we've had this discussion. I agreed with you 15 years ago when comic buying was walk in, look at the rack, talk to the salespeople, and pick up comics. I agreed with you. It was vital. When the physical locations became, hey, here's a copy of previews, make sure you get your order in. At that point, it might as well be mail order anyways. It's the same difference.
Well,
shopping that way for over 15 years, both mail order, and then I don't remember the last time I didn't have a pull list at a comic store for any length of time, for more than a month period of time. There were a few times there.
And I'll kind of give you a little bit of an inside scoop. So my mail order portion of the business has roughly about a third of the customers that we have subscriber pull boxes for in the store. I end up purchasing 24 copies of previews and all of its inserts for my subscribers. So a third of the store, I get 24 copies. For the store, we have two people who order previews and we put 10 on the counter, and most months we'll have anywhere from 2 to 5 left over. So there's a significant difference. Again, yes, there's a previews catalog, but there's still a ton of off-the-shelf sales. There's a lot of people like you, Sam, that just, I don't even want to have to, that's not part of how I want to consume and not part of what I should have to do to order my books. That's fine. Okay. It's your choice because that just means whatever's on the shelf when you come in, that's what you have to pick from. And there's a lot of people that are perfectly comfortable with that. And there's other people that are like John and myself and, you know, a number of other individuals who are like, well, I want to make sure I get this because I know I want to know what's going on. And so we use that as a mechanism for us to get what we know we want or what we're sure we would want to read. So no way is right or wrong, but I was just using that as an example to say, just because we went to a pre-order market doesn't mean that the majority of the market shops in that direction. And it would actually be really interesting to know how many copies of previews Diamond ships. Every store gets a comp copy, or every account, I guess, gets a comp copy, so we get two. But it would be interesting to know what that number is.
And again, it's not even a matter of previews. But to be fair, listening to you and James on your own podcast, when you talk, or times you've said things on here. Oh, yeah, that book, I don't think much of it. I'm going to get subs, maybe one for the rack.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning the majority of your business is pre-ordered, whether it's through previews or through some other mechanism. You're not really putting the product out there to sell.
Well, subscriber doesn't, to me, is different than a previews purchaser. A subscriber is just someone that says, I want to make sure I get Batman every time it comes out.
Okay.
And that's more of a, the way that I think of it, that's more of a, when Batman hits the shelf, put one of those in my box. I have a count of how many people get Batman, I buy it. I don't think it's any different really than, you know, people on the newsstand that had returnability 35, 40 years ago. They would say, well, I usually sell 25 off the stand, so we'll get 30. And if five go back, five go back. That's yep. Essentially subs plus five.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, stores have worked that way for decades. It just used to be a lot more work to do it.
Yeah, yeah, and a little less risk.
It always concerns me that there is an attitude among resellers that, I don't want to work to have to sell this. I'm just going to order what I already have sold, which at what point the store becomes pointless.
Exactly.
Ordering what I've already has sold used to be a ton of work to do because okay. You had to know how much you had already sold. And again, back when I was working at a store in Southern California, that meant once a month, I'd come in on a Saturday, help the owner of the store. I'd be over at the rack. He's like, okay, how many do we have left of Green Lantern? Of each issue, count, number, yep. You know, all this kind of stuff, which is now, you know, you have potentially the option of doing either, you know, electronically with some inventory control type stuff if you've got a point of sale system, or at the very least with a computer and a spreadsheet.
Well, like I said, what following trends on what tends to sell in your store through like a POS system or a physical count is very different to me than saying subs. Because if, you know, let's say whatever, I've got five Batman subscribers, but I always order 50 and I usually sell all but one or two. Okay, you're creating 42 customers worth of sales with your store.
Are you suggesting subs is better, superior or inferior data to essentially doing the cycle sheets?
I'm not saying it's inferior data. I'm saying it makes the store less vital.
Either way, the same person's buying it through the same store. I don't see how it makes the store any more or less vital.
Because Eric's argument to why a place like Amazon couldn't take over was the tactile. A guy who just says, I want Batman. If it just shows up on his door every month, what does he care? A guy who comes in, looks around, says, hey, what do you got? Hey, Batman looks cool. I like Batman. I'll take one. That, the direct market created a sale. Guy who just says, I want Batman every month, direct market didn't do anything. What?
How did the guy know he wanted Batman?
Well, like I said, the guy who walks in off the street and says, hey, what? Ooh, you got a comic. Hey, I like Batman. I'll take one. That, the store created. A guy who says, give me one of every Batman every month, if you just tell him, sorry, we're closing, you have to order it from this website, he gets the exact same service, and the store is not vital. Which store it is doesn't play in that.
And that's
nor
that's,
is it tactile.
That's true for current purchasers, but I just think you're going to see a dramatic decline in new people entering the market to buy, because how are they going to know where to start? How are they going to know what's new? How are they going to know when you've got literally this past week, 8 Batman titles come out in 1 week. Well, what's Batman? Who's Batman? Which one is the Batman? There's nothing there for them. There's no person at the other end to help. And there's no way that they can look inside and go, oh, this is the Batman I have in my head. Right? So when you go to Amazon, you say, give me Batman, type Batman into Amazon, you probably get 6 million results.
Yep.
It's like, how many fans of radio dramas are there these days? Well, none, because there's no radio dramas to speak of. But, you know, if you're a fan of a radio drama and you can just order it online or whatever, I mean, there seems to be a similar argument to be had there. And to suggest that everyone who goes in saying, oh, there's a Batman issue on the rack, I'll just pick it up, could be, you know, satisfied by just, you know, clicking a button saying, anytime there's a Batman thing, send it to me. It'll just show up magically on my doorstep. I think there's a lot of people who wouldn't do that.
I, again, you misunderstood what I said. I agree with you. The guy who walks in and goes, hey, there's a Batman there, and takes it, I completely agree with you. The guy who says to the comic shop, hey, every time there's a Batman, put it in my box, I'll come in so often and pick it up. Him is the exact same as clicking a button somewhere and having it show up on his door.
Yeah, and what I'm saying is that your first guy doesn't become the second guy if not for the store. Your first guy that wanders in and says, I'll take a Batman comic, doesn't turn into the guy that says, I'll take Batman every month without the store.
I absolutely agree with that.
Doing that conversion from the I'll pick it up if I see it to, hey, set it aside for me, is showing both a certain amount of commitment to the title and arguably a certain amount of laziness of just, hey, set it aside so I don't miss it. And I think doing that to a mail order thing where I'm going to pay up front for the privilege is another level of commitment. And it's hard enough to get people to commit to buying the thing if they see it on the rack, but to get to those other two levels of commitment, I don't know.
Well, and I've argued this for years, and it's one of the things I do think where Amazon has a huge advantage over most of the mail order comic companies. And it's a reason I buy a fairly large percent of my trades through a company like Amazon. They don't ask for payment until they ship it. That is where direct market lost me. When they said, I want, at that point, I might as well just have an account with Diamond. Pick out what you want and pay me, and we'll ship it to you when it comes out of it. At that point, I might as well be dealing with the distributor.
You wouldn't place a large enough order, sir.
But you understand what I'm saying.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it's a matter, though, of, based on the sales we're seeing on this year-end chart, how many people do we think are hard enough core fans that if they could deal straight with Diamond, they would?
I'm not sure. And we went through it. I'm still not sure what in these numbers shows you people. I don't think there's 574,000 people that necessarily wanted to read a Detective Comics issue.
And I'm not suggesting there are. I'm suggesting there are absolutely no more than that many who want a physical copy.
Of course. Okay.
So this is the ceiling.
Okay.
And we see that a lot of these things are well below that anomalous number of Detective Comics.
Okay.
You know, we get down to the below 100,000 mark by the time we get out of down to rank, 56 or something here.
Oh.
So tops, we're talking, 100,000 people for a few of these things. You know, it's not too much further before we're below 75,000 or 50,000 or something like that. So we're talking a fairly niche audience here. Now, granted, there's going to be overlap between, Batman readers and Detective Comics readers and stuff like that, no doubt. But I don't think we're talking a large enough body of actual people that are buying whatever subset of this actually make it into end reader hands like myself or something, that this is a viable thing for the mass market to bother with, given the hassles and the number of different products and the importance of condition on the product and stuff like that.
I don't disagree with any of that. Question then becomes, though, if I'm a publisher, particularly one of the big two that got giant corporations above them, is the question they have to be asking is, how do they become a mass market product? Not how do I cater more and more to this small niche market?
And they've answered that already.
Well, seemingly they haven't been able to figure it out. DC, as we've talked about, seems to just not be making this small niche market happy. And Marvel has responded by more number ones, more multiple covers. Let's see if we can squeeze more dollars out of this shrinking group of people.
Well, hang on a sec. You asked how to get it, how to repurpose the stuff as mass market products, and then you stayed limited to the subsets of their company that are comic book publishers.
Okay.
I would argue that they've both shown great success in this area. DC with things like the CW shows and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
Marvel with all of the movies and stuff. Those are clearly mass market products.
Okay. I don't disagree with that.
I don't think getting comic books to be mass market is really on the table these days. I don't think getting books, even prose novels of legitimate, quote-unquote, literature, is on the table as mass market for the most part either. We're talking about getting people to read, which I don't think Americans are incredibly predisposed to be prone to do, and doing it with, niche genres.
Interestingly enough, if you look at the book numbers, the niche genres outdo literature by miles.
That doesn't surprise me. Literature's overrated.
Reading. Bunch of snooty people.
Reading, yeah.
But the mystery people, the romance people, the sci-fi people, they all buy a lot more books than the literature people.
But how many of the comics we've got on this list do you think really qualify as a legitimate mystery the way a mystery novel tends to, or legitimate romance the way a romance novel would, or legitimate sci-fi?
Well, no, but that's something I've talked about for years. And the fact that we talk about these, because I would argue some of the things on this list are very different from some of the other things on this list. It's interesting how the word comics gets used sometimes as a medium and sometimes as a genre.
I try not to use it as a genre. I consider it a medium. There is a high preponderance of the superhero genre within that medium.
Mm-hmm.
But I also think there's a low amount of stories that are told. Most of the stories that we get here are almost more similar to a police procedural TV show than a mystery novel or a sci-fi novel or something like that.
Oh, absolutely.
There's a thin veneer of a mystery plot, although it's usually fairly thin. And there's a lot of character thing and spectacle around the story.
To be fair, I would argue mystery writers, or like the Edgar Allan Poe, the Poe Awards every year, have gone, this isn't new, this is the last 20 years, kind of since we've seen the rise in television. The mystery genre, even in prose novels, has gone much more procedural than old school Agatha Christie mysteries in a long time, too.
I guess for me, the difference is in a police procedural, because you've got that half or that hour long limit or whatever, you get the setup of the crime to be solved.
Yep.
The let's go solve it. The two or three, you know, false suspects leading to the real one, a twist and some character moments in between.
Oh, yes.
There's not really a collecting of clues, a figure out the mystery, a fair play kind of a mystery as you would often get in a novel.
Yes, and I would argue you need to read more modern mystery novels because they're much closer to what you just described. They're much more close to what you see on television than what you just described.
That's fair. I have not read many mystery novels of that are current. I can think of only one or two that I've done in the last few years.
Yeah.
And I've actually done an episode on one of them.
Yes, you have.
So I don't think the sales we had this year were bad, but we've got a couple of things that were definitely, again, what we've talked about a number of times at the top of the list. Number ones, magic number issues, events, things like that. I don't think there was any kind of really surprise, wow, that was a story that just took us by storm that we hadn't expected. The closest to that, Immortal Hulk, but that's already a few years in. And good that it's still going with that. I just would like to see a little bit more representation on some of the other publishers here and some of the other properties, particularly within DC. I think Marvel's got a better mix of properties and stuff out there at the top of this list. But again, some of that is also, you know, if we could filter out the sales noise from the various cover gimmicks and stuff, it would be interesting to see what shook out. You know, will we still see some of these things as high as they are?
Yeah, I think that's the most interesting. Like you said, Immortal Hulk is the one that stands out as, wow, it's kind of different than all the rest of these.
This is where I'd love to get my hands on some data behind the scenes from Comixology, where they could actually track how far into things do people read. Not just, hey, they clicked on it and were curious about it, but did they actually read through to the end of the story? Did they immediately go to the next? There's so much information that could be data mined out of the Comixology data or Digital Comics Unlimited over at Marvel, or potentially even the DC Universe stuff at DC. That they could really, I think, data drive some decisions on how to tell better stories that are more engaging. I don't know if anyone's even thinking about doing that, and if any company was, I suspect it might be Marvel. They just seem to have had a bit more tech savvy over the years than some of the other publishers. If we jump over to the prices, man, we've got tons of high point price points and stuff, but man, $3.99, just the overwhelming winner. Followed closely by, you know, not closely, but about half the sale, half the number of items and stuff, with $4.99. When you go by units, it winds up to be about just under 12.8 million units at the $3.99 price point for the top 300 comics for the year, and a little over 8 million units at the $4.99. And then you get down to about 1.8 for $5.99, 1.1 million for $7.99. Thankfully, under a million with about 0.86 million for the $9.99 price point. And then, man, it just falls off for the $2.99 for the half million there that's still around. in terms of actually, I think I've, no, I'm sorry. It's 179,000. I shifted over to the dollars accidentally. Too many columns. So yeah, there's just not much happening at 299, and what little does, the sales aren't that much.
I think those three items are all spawn.
I think so. Yeah. Issues 289, 299, and 302. And then there's only a single item at 699, and that was a third issue of Batman Damned. And again, this is just within the top 300 for the year.
Yep.
So I think part of it is when they know they've got something that's going to sell well, they'll charge more for it. There's a certain, you know, mercenary aspect to that. And I get it. I don't necessarily fault them for that, but I don't think it's doing them any long-term favors either. So anything else you guys want to talk about on this?
Whew. I don't think I've got anything else.
Yeah, unless you guys want to take the time to look at the creators.
We talked a little about the writers. I think with the artists, there's not a whole lot there because they tend to be more limited to a single title a month. I do want to jump over to the title status stuff for a few minutes.
Sure.
What I did is I totaled up the units for each of the categories for each of the month, then did, you know, what was the total for the year, what was the min, the average, the max, and stuff like that, just to kind of see where most of the units are falling. And as I had strongly suspected, usually it's happening in the lost sales area. This is anything where stable sales I had defined as losing less than 250 units, which, as we've talked about before, was both an arbitrary number and probably a poor choice to begin with, in so much as losing 250 units if you're selling 10,000 units is very different than losing 250 units if you're selling 100,000 units. So doing it to a percentage basis, I think, makes sense. So I'm already starting to toy around with the idea of taking the stable sales and lost sales categories out and replacing them with three categories for sales that have gone down. One that would be like a 5% drop or less, maybe, for, you know, kind of a standard attrition. And then from that 5% to, I don't know, maybe 50% for, it's more than standard. And then that 50% or more of, man, the bottom just fell out from under this.
Yeah, I guess the way that I look at it in my head is I kind of take for a title, I will take a rolling 6-month average and assume that if there's a 2% swing up or down, that's kind of within the margin of error. Now, obviously, when you don't get six issues, that gets a little bit trickier. But for those ongoing titles, that's kind of where I'm at, is about 2% seems to be around what I kind of see or feel as a normal range up or down.
I guess part of my goal here is to even out where the titles land across categories, to where I don't have, you know, over, you know, a third of the list winding up in one category of lost sales.
Mm-hmm.
And figuring out those, it's like, okay, the other problem with doing a running average or whatever for the title is there's so many cover gimmicks going on and stuff like that, that I think finding that signal through the noise would be quite a bit of work if at all possible.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing I'm planning on doing, and I just haven't had time to yet, is basically do a historical trend on, for things that lose sales, by what percentage do they tend to do it? And then what's, you know, where are the sweet spots for where those boundaries would make the most sense to not a big deal, could be a big deal, to absolutely a big deal. But I'm open to feedback from you guys and from the listeners as to what would be kind of more meaningful categories for that. And I'm also toying with the idea of, instead of doing it on number of units for the title for the month, doing it on the number of units divided by the number of items, so it's an average sales, to get rid of potentially the more units, fewer issues categories. I don't know about that yet. It's just what we're seeing is there's usually a fair amount of the list every month that is coming from new titles, which is not too surprising. There's quite a bit that also comes from the gain sales in some months, but that really comes down to cover gimmicks and things of that sort. And some of these other categories, like the annuals and specials and the non-series, aren't that big of a deal, so I may end up merging those. I'm trying to figure out what's a better model for figuring out why do the numbers change for the top 300 from month to month. And I think the model I've had has served its purpose for the last couple of years. I'm just wondering if there's now time for a version 2 of it that shines some new light on this. So if you guys have thoughts on that, or if the listeners have thoughts, I'd definitely like to hear. So that's about all I had.
Okay.
So we'll come back when we get a chance for the December numbers, even though I've hidden some of those in here. And then as soon as I can get a new working vetted version of the new spreadsheets and stuff, we'll cut over to those, hopefully sometime in early 2020, if I can make that happen. So with that, we'll call it an episode.
Sounds like a plan.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics has usually used the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or as few as 10 items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and English language itself seem to work very differently there.